The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome. This week, we're casting our gaze far and wide across world literature, a domain in which translators play a crucial role, increasingly and rightly acknowledged as artists in their own right. But many of the world's books never make it out of their own lands, and some countries have never had a single novel translated into English. On today's programme, we hear from Anne Morgan, who sought to address that by reading her way around 196 countries, no less. We also hear from author Han Kang, who tells us about her book, The Vegetarian, and the other South Korean literature we've yet to read. Plus, S.J. Norde discusses translating his own collection of short stories from Afrikaans into English and the current trends in South African literature. That's all to come. We start today with Anne Morgan. In 2012, during the London Olympic Games, Morgan decided to read her way around 196 countries. The obstacles soon became obvious. Here she is with an extract from Reading the World, Confessions of a Literary Explorer.
Here's a challenge. Go into your local bookshop and count up how many nations are represented on its shelves. If you don't have time to tot it up, ask someone behind the counter. Assuming they're able to tell you, I'll warrant you won't find literature by authors from more than around 70 or roughly one-third of the world's nations available to buy. When I asked blog visitors to do the same thing a while ago, that was the highest number that anyone came across, with many shops only offering works from 20 or 30 countries. From the glossiest emporium to the quirkiest wordmongers, the story was the same. The majority of the world was off limits. The truth is that the odds are stacked against most books from elsewhere ever reaching us, particularly when they are written in languages other than English. With just over 4% of fiction, poetry and drama published in the UK and Ireland, according to research by Literature Across Frontiers, in the region of 3% of all texts released in the US originating from other languages, and a mere half a dozen or so translations published every year in translation, the proportion of translated titles on the average English language bookshop shelves will only ever be tiny. When you consider the implications of these statistics for the number of books reaching us from specific language groups, the results are sobering. Literature Across Frontiers found that only 22 of the books published in the UK and Ireland in 2008 were translations of works originally written in Arabic. 21 were Chinese, and a mere 11 were Polish, six fewer than the 17 works carried over from Latin in the same period. Even with Stieg Larsson becoming the second best-selling author in the world that year, after Khaled Hosseini, a mere 42 of the books we saw in that 12-month stretch were Swedish. Small beans when you think that 129,057 new and revised titles came out in the UK during that time. The upshot is that there are many nations with work by only one or two writers available to buy in English, and plenty that have no literature at all represented in the Anglophone market. With books from elsewhere forced into a Darwinian struggle to make it through the bottleneck and attain the incomparable reach that release in the world's most published and most translated language makes possible, competition is fierce. By and large, only those titles with the shrewdest and most powerful backers stand a chance of landing an English language deal. As a result, countries with weak publishing traditions or economies that make it impossible to put up the funding often required to persuade a British house to take a risk on an unknown foreign author lag woefully behind. Though French might be the language most frequently translated into English, coming top in all of the three sample years in Literature Across Frontiers study, with well over 100 literary texts each time, the majority of these books will be from French-speaking countries with strong networks. Francophone Africa will largely not get a look in. In fact, much of Africa rarely gets a look in when it comes to translation. Leaving aside works written in the continent's numerous indigenous tongues, which, despite making up around one third of the planet's languages, are hardly ever translated, you'd be hard pushed to get hold of English versions of anything written in the European languages that are official in many states there. To date, you won't find a single commercially available translation of a Malagasy novel, even though, judging by the array of extracts, short stories and poetry published in the 2002 anthology Voices from Madagascar, there are numerous interesting French language writers in this nation of more than 22 million people. Look for work from Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Gabon and Guinea, and beyond a handful of classics and trailblazers, Mongo Betty and Norbert Zongo among them, you'll draw a blank.
And that was a chapter from Reading the World, which gives some idea of this massive task you set yourself.
Yes.
To read your way around the world in a given time span?
Yes, in a year, 1 year, 2012.
Which followed the year of Reading Women, which was another massive task, but involved only half the population.
Oh, well, yes, it did. Although I wasn't doing the world with the year of Reading Women. A year of Reading Women was a really quite a small blog that I did just for my personal interest. And a year of Reading Women had come about because I realised I didn't read books by women writers and I didn't really understand why that was. It made no sense, particularly as I was an aspiring woman writer. While I was doing a year of Reading Women, an American visitor came to that blog and left a comment saying he really wanted me to read a novel, an Australian novel that he was passionate about and I would love. I said, oh, sounds interesting, you know, what is it? And he said it was Cloud Street by Tim Winton. I said, oh, well, sounds great, but I'll have to read it next year because I'm only reading women this year. And he then came back and said, well, are you doing a blog next year? Because I need to know what you think of this book. I thought, gosh, you know, who is this person? But I said, well, okay, if you can suggest a sort of angle, I'll consider it, you know. And he said, well, what about books from different countries? And I got rather indignant at this point. I was like, well, who does he think I am? Doesn't he think I'm not very cultured? And then I looked up at my bookshelves and I realised that actually most of the books up there were British or American. There were a handful of South African authors and one or two Australians and the odd Indian novel. But beyond that, really very little and nothing in translation. And that didn't make sense to me. I thought, why on earth am I limiting myself to such a small tranche of what must be out there? That seems like a very short-sighted thing to do. So I decided to correct this by prescribing myself an intensive reading course and spending 2012 trying to see if I could read a book from every country.
And that involved, in its original formulation, 195 countries plus Taiwan.
Yes.
Why plus Taiwan?
Well, actually, Taiwan used to be a UN member, so there isn't one answer to the question, how many countries in the world are there? There are lots of different answers, and it depends on your politics. I was anxious to choose a politically neutral list, and so I decided I wanted to do UN-recognised countries. Actually, as it turned out, I slightly miscalculated, and I was doing American-recognised countries for the first few months, but I rectified that. And during that year, Palestine became recognised by the UN as a non-member state. It had been a non-member entity. So that took the number up to 195. But Taiwan, it was on the American list. And actually, when I looked at Taiwan, I thought, well, it used to be a UN member. So I decided to keep it on the list. And actually, towards the end of the year, I became increasingly conscious of all these other territories that weren't included in this list. And so I did one extra book, which was my Rest of the World book, which blog visitors chose. And that ended up being a book from Kurdistan, The Man in Blue Pyjamas. And then I felt at least went some way to represent those unrepresented territories as well.
This book is unusual in a way, or it's very sort of modern in that it comes out of the blogosphere and it belongs to a blog community.
Yes. The first indication of the kindness that people were going to show me was when 4 days after I wrote a very short appeal just saying, this is what I want to do, can you make any suggestions? I got a message from a woman in Kuala Lumpur called Rafida, a perfect stranger. I have no idea how she heard about the project. But she said, I love the sound of this project. I'd like to go to my local English language bookshop and choose your Malaysian book and post it to you. Would you let me do that? And I jumped at the chance. You know, oh, how wonderful, how amazing that someone would do this. And I sent off this message. And then I realised, oh, gosh, I've got to do this now. 6,000 miles away, there's a stranger going to a bookshop. But actually, that became the pattern for the year. Time and again, people went to extraordinary lengths to help, sending me, like digging through all kinds of material to find information for me, going to bookshops and sending me pictures of what was on the shelves, sending me books, sending me unpublished translations when I couldn't get hold of anything. And actually, in one case, a team of volunteers even translated a book from scratch for me, just to help me achieve the goal of reading something from every country.
What about South Sudan, which is such a new country? How
That's
did you
right.
find something from South Sudan?
South Sudan was incredible, actually. It had only become a country 5 months before my quest started on the 9th of July 2011. And given the challenges they were facing, given the fact there were no hospitals and very little basic infrastructure, I was pretty confident that there wouldn't have been much in the way of a publishing industry. I was very lucky that I had actually been in contact with someone who was working in the new South Sudan government. And I thought, if anyone can help me, this person can. It was a guy called Dengesh Powell. And he said, well, I know this writer, she works with me, and she wrote a book before independence, but perhaps she'd be prepared to write something for you, specially. So actually, my South Sudanese choice was not a book. It was a short story written specially, which I recorded. And we released it on the first new year of South Sudan, her reading this short story, which was an incredible thing, really, to, you know, have to be a publisher, actually, of some of the first literature coming out of South Sudan.
To forgive is divine, not human. South Sudan became independent on July 9, 2011. There were tears of jubilation and happiness and disbelief that we were free at last. I myself could not believe that it was happening.
I went last year to Korea, and I was interested that the British Council called it the Korea market focus. They didn't differentiate between North and South Korea.
Oh, how interesting.
But you have made that differentiation.
Yes, yes.
But getting some the literature from North Korea must have been pretty difficult.
It was. It was an interesting one, actually. I ended up having an email conversation with North Korea. Initially, I thought perhaps I would get some literature by someone who'd defected. You know, there are lots of really compelling narratives out there. And I thought, well, you know, perhaps that would be the thing to do. But then I thought, well, actually, that's not going to tell me anything about stories inside North Korea, what's published there. And I'd actually be interested to know that, if that's possible. So I discovered there's a chap called Alejandro Cao de Benos, who is an employee of the North Korean government. As his name suggests, he's not actually North Korean by origin. He was born in Spain, but he grew up obsessed with North Korea and decided it was his life's ambition to go and work for them. And he persuaded them to let him be a North Korean citizen. And they changed the law so that he could work for the government, because previously foreigners weren't allowed to do that. He's a special delegate, and he has to build ties of culture and business and friendship with the rest of the world, which is quite a tall order, really. But he does this partly through a website called the Korean Friends Association, and it's possible to contact him. So I emailed him saying, you know, this is what I'm doing. Can you suggest anything? He came back with a suggestion of some folk stories, which he said were based in historical fact, showing loyalty to the motherland, and that this was a value that was present in all North Korean literature. So I thought, well, okay, let's see how far I can push this. So I said, well, I'd be particularly interested in contemporary fiction, if there's any contemporary fiction that you could recommend. And I got this quite confusing reply back, where he said, well, no fiction has been published in the 70-year history of the Republic. Everything is based in historic fact. Now, I found this slightly surprising, because I knew that fiction had been published, because there was an anthology produced by Words Without Borders a few years ago, which featured some North Korean short stories. And so I went back to him and I said, well, perhaps the word fiction isn't quite, we're not meaning the same thing by it. So I said, you know, actually what I mean is stories like these by these writers, you know, is there anything you can suggest? And sadly, at that point, Kim Jong-il died. And of course, it was the perfect get out of jail free clause for him, because, you know, the country went into, you know, a huge state of mourning, and I didn't hear any more. But I did then hear from a chap running a website on North Korean literature. He was based in Canada, but he recommended a memoir, which was by a war correspondent who had been held prisoner in South Korea for 30 years and then sent back home finally, and it was published in Pyongyang in English. And I read that. It's a very interesting read, quite problematic. And of course, I had no way of knowing what had been done to it, who had been involved in its production, and how much was true. But it was actually much more thought-provoking than I'd expected.
And from South Korea, you chose Hwang Sok-yong, who we've actually interviewed on this,
yes,
on this
guest,
podcast.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The Guest was published in 1991. Is
that's
there
right.
any more recent?
There is. There's a very interesting novel that's recently out called The Vegetarian. And I was very interested to hear about it because the premise is it's about a woman who becomes a vegetarian overnight, inexplicably. And in South Korea, this is still quite a rarity. It's something that people find difficult to understand. And there isn't much provision for vegetarianism in the culture. The book is about how her family deals with, or rather doesn't deal with, this sudden change in her lifestyle choice. And it begins to show them unravelling and throws up some of the traumas in their background that are forced to the surface by this abrupt shift. And I heard about it when the chief fiction buyer for Foyles tweeted about it and said that it was his first great read of 2015. And I thought, well, that had to be worth looking at. And indeed it was. It was a fascinating book, very powerful, quite shocking at times, very visceral imagery, but a really engrossing read.
Anne Morgan. And Reading the World, Confessions of a Literary Explorer is published by Harville Secker. But wait, that's not the end of the story, as we managed to track down Anne Morgan's South Korean author, Han Kang. Richard Lee went to meet her and started by asking how she began writing The Vegetarian.
In 1997, I have published a short story named The Fruit of My Woman, and it's about a woman who suddenly became a plant, and her husband potted her in their balcony and watered her. And
she kind of turns green. And
yes, right. And then as time goes by, he turned yellow and eventually she withered. And in the end, the husband wondered about the possibility if she can bloom again or not. And that was the end of the short story. And after I finished the story, I felt I would like to variate this motif someday. And after some years, I began to write this novel. But there never happens supernatural things in this novel.
It's very doggedly realist, isn't it? It's almost
yes.
terrifyingly so. These terrible things happen and they're definitely going on.
Yes, and in this novel, the protagonist, Young-hae, suddenly decides to become a vegetarian, a very strict vegetarian. And she is suffering from the disturbing dreams. And because of her resolution, her family faces a catastrophe, and then she eventually wants to become a plant. And she believes that she is becoming a plant, and she refuses all the food, and she is starving, and she is getting closer and closer to death. And that is the story.
You say that she wants to eliminate human violence, mm-hmm. and of course that brings down, in the end, violence upon her. Reviewers in the UK have read this novel as a critique of Korean society and its constrictions, suggesting that it's the crushing pressure of Korean etiquette that murders her in the end. Did you set out to make a political point with this book?
Well, I feel this novel is more universal, I think. It's not protesting Korean society or, can I say, Korean patriarch. I just wanted to deal with human violence and the attempt to be purely innocent, and the possibility that a human being can be innocent in a pure way, you know. So I think if you interpret this novel as a protest for Korean society, it can make this novel very narrow, I think.
Whereas your human violence is broader than that, and we're all in some way complicit in the violent things going on throughout the world. Despite the effort of publishers like Portobello and Dulce Archive, there's only a handful of Korean authors who are available for English-speaking readers to get hold of, which makes you into a kind of cultural ambassador for Korea, whether you like it or not. How do you feel as with taking on that role?
Well, it's heavy. it's possible because there are not many Korean novels translated in UK, so it is really possible that you can interpret this novel as a very Korean thing. But when I visited Buenos Aires, because this novel was published in Argentina, and they interpreted this novel as a very symbolic one, because they eat meat a lot. Three times a day they eat meat, and they said refusing meat means refusing life. And they interpreted this novel as a very Catholic one. So some of them thought Young-hye, the protagonist, is abandoning her life to become a pure, innocent being and to eliminate human violence in a very Christian way. And I thought it was a very interesting interpretation. And I hope the readers in UK could interpret this novel in a more universal way. It's my hope.
Do you feel, as you write, part of a kind of a world of letters? Do you read writers from other countries? Do you, yourself, do you feel part of a kind of international effort?
In Korea, there are many people who are curious about world literature, so there are so many novels and poetry and plays which are published, translated into Korean and published and read broadly. So since when I was very little, I grew up with world literature. And surely I grew up with Korean literature, but yes, I am a part of this world.
Han Kang talking to Richard Lee. The Vegetarian is translated by Deborah Smith and is out now from Portobello Books. Coming next, continuing our translation theme, S.J. Norde discusses translating his own short story collection.
This new year, make a resolution to dust off that big idea. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the powerful platform that gives you simple tools to create a gorgeous website in minutes. With elegant templates, Getty image integration, and marketing tools, you can make your ideas resonate with the world. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
So far today, we've discussed getting your work translated, but not the art of translating itself. S.J. Norde has just completed a collection of short stories in both Afrikaans and English. The Alphabet of Birds follows the lives of South African expats making their mark on the wider world and confronting what they've lost in the process. Richard Lee sat down with Norde earlier to find out how he started the process of translating his own work.
It's interesting because I spent 16 years of my life outside South Africa, hardly speaking Afrikaans. Upon my return to South Africa, the Afrikaans then, as it were, re-emerged, you know, almost intact, almost, if you will, like an ancient mosquito in amber.
Well, it rose up around you.
Yes, exactly. And but of course, it's something of a fallacy, this intactness, because the language had moved on in the meantime too. And in South Africa, even though it has 11 official languages, the true current official language is perhaps broken English, as most South Africans would not have English as a first language. So the Afrikaans that I spoke when I returned here was perhaps somewhat artificial, a slightly over-formal or slightly too archaic version of Afrikaans. And I didn't really know how people spoke anymore. So when I wrote dialogue initially, for instance, for these stories, the dialogue was initially written in English quite often, and then I would carefully listen around and then translate it back into Afrikaans, but a certain Afrikaans register that would fit with a current register. So there was originally some writing in English, and then it was translated back into Afrikaans, and then all of it went back into English. So even when I write now, there's a certain, almost a certain kind of synchronicity. The Afrikaans and English happen almost simultaneously. As I write Afrikaans, the English is playing almost like a soundtrack in the back of one's mind.
Yeah, so that they're very much kind of a piece rather than something that you've transformed from one to another. I'm wondering if you said that the Afrikaans you were speaking had become somewhat archaic. I'm wondering if Afrikaans as a language in some sense is a bit like your characters, these characters who are not quite at home with themselves, if it's kind of adrift from this globalized world.
Yes, I think, well, I think speaking Afrikaans, again, after such a long time of not speaking, so many years of not speaking, it had interesting effects. One had a sense of a slight distance from it. It was almost like, as I say, rediscovering a language, but speaking a second language with a kind of consciousness that one didn't have before. It is possible that these characters are a representative of, you know, white South Africans or Afrikaans-speaking South Africans who are drifting the world, but, you know, at the same time, I think there's such an extent of diaspora these days of South Africans that South Africans do find themselves at home, I think, quite easily in many parts of the world now.
I was wondering, I mean, there's the description of the room in the castle suspended in the ruin, that the box within the box surrounded by dizzying space and tumbling beams and floors receding into the distance. It seemed to me a very nice description of your stories, in a way, that you've got this beautiful space around which the world spills outwards. Was that something you were aiming for here, or was it very much more kind of instinctive process?
I think a mix of the two. I recall once a psychotherapist in social conversation mentioned this notion of the proximity often of very good and very bad states of mind, and I think that image was possibly born out of that whole notion of, you know, something which is very beautiful and something which is quite dreadful, being in close proximity. And I think the stories have some of that too. The characters and the characters all face major losses. In each case, I think they try to construct a certain world of beauty, of something that provides aesthetic consolation. And perhaps writing a story is a very similar kind of endeavor. And sometimes, I guess, one can write through a loss also personally by creating fiction.
These stories range from a Berlin nightclub to a fancy London restaurants, from a Pretoria slum to a shopping mall in Dubai. But there's a striking similarity of tone and method to go along with some recurring characters as well. I wonder, have you ever considered turning these into a novel?
You know, I think quite a few people have told me that these read like mini novels, and in a sense, they are probably more like pre-modern short stories, you know, which were condensed novels, almost like a D.H. Lawrence-type short story, rather than an Edgar Allan Poe-type short story. And perhaps many of them have the ability to turn many of these into a novel, quite possibly. I'm currently working on a novel, but at the time that these short stories were written, I was quite happy. I think I often write the stories with a certain kind of urgency. I like to get the story out. I like to get to the end of it. And the stories seem to get a lot of the energy from being written in that sort of fashion, that sort of feverish, almost automatic kind of writing. The pen being put on paper and making its own patterns. But I can see that each of them, or many of them, could form the core of a novel, or could have been developed into novels.
Your white South Africans in the collection are adrift from what one of them calls this strange continent. They seem never at home in it, but unable to resist its pull. Is that how it feels to be a white South African with an encumbering passport, as one of them describes it, at the beginning of the 21st century?
I think South Africans, white South Africans particularly, have traditionally had almost a 19th century notion of home when it comes to South Africa. It's almost a sense of South African exceptionalism, you know, home being more of a home than home anywhere else. It's a somewhat new thing for South Africans to be living scattered across the world. But the reality is, of course, that living in cosmopolitan cities is for many other people in the world nothing very new. And so I don't think one should be too precious about it. There is the experience of exile or migration, which is, I guess, are different kinds of experience. The one is the experience which causes one to end up in an overloaded boat in the Mediterranean or in a holding cell or detainment camp somewhere in the Australian hinterland. And then there's the other kind of experience, which I personally have had, which is a rather privileged one, where one leaves the country of one's birth and studies with scholarships elsewhere and has a professional life in Western metropolises. But I think there's a certain psychology that is probably salient to any kind of migration. I think one ends up often in a place where one is constantly translating your cultural world to yourself and yourself to that world. And one probably ends up in a kind of in-between world in many ways. It has its gains, it has its exhilaration, its excitements, but it also has its losses. That is the situation in which quite a lot of South Africans find themselves currently.
S.J. Norde there. The Alphabet of Birds is out now from And Other Stories, translated by, you guessed it, S.J. Norde. And that's it for today's programme. My thanks, as ever, to Richard Lee and our guests Anne Morgan, Han Kang and S.J. Norde. If you have a burning issue you'd like us to explore or people you'd like to hear about, please tell us about them. You can leave comments on our podcast page, that's at theguardian.com/books, or tweet us at Guardian Books. I'm Claire Armistead. The producer was Matt Hill. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.